Hello and welcome to Spy Hards Podcast. I'm Agent Scott.
And I'm Ken the Provocateur, studying to become a salesman.
And boy, do you do it so well. And speaking of doing it well, we've been celebrating 2020's The Courier this week. Of course, we sat down with Ian from Cold War Conversations to decode the movie at the beginning of the week. And then we just brought you a couple of days ago a sit down with the film's screenwriter, Mr. Tom O'Connor. But we mentioned in the review that many years ago, we actually did a declassified episode on The Courier. And as part of that, we sat down with the film's director, Mr. Dominic Cook. So what we thought we'd do is we'd pull out the full-length version of that interview and bring that to you here as well to give you the comprehensive Courier experience. So, Cam, I think without further ado, let's get to the interview. And we are joined by the director of The Courier, Dominic Cook. Dominic, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Now, I realize our time is short, so we are going to fire some questions at you as fast as we can. But I'll start us off. So we just reviewed the film on the episode. And the first thing I really wanted to know is what brought you to this film? What got you interested in telling the story?
Well, I was sent the script with a big pile of scripts to my agents in the US. I just sort of finished a film and they were like, right, we've got to get you next film. Like, okay. And I read a bunch of scripts and I just loved this script. I just immediately loved it. The story was extraordinary. I didn't even know it was a true story. There's nothing on the script that said this is a true story. Of course, as it sort of developed, I thought this has to be a true story. And then at the end of it, I found out that it was, sort of got really into the research. But I think for me, in the end, what really sort of won me over was the fact that it had sort of a warmth than most spy stories. There are so many spy movies that are sort of that have the coldness of the calculation that is the center of the action of the film, but you don't really get much cost of it, the personal cost and the sort of relationships, the sort of personal relationships at the heart of it. And because this story involved a sort of regular person rather than a trained operative, it allowed the space for that, and that really sort of moved me and brought me to it.
Okay, so I'm interested there. You know, we tackle spy movies every week, and there's such an established tone to spy movies. I'm curious if you were looking at any, you know, spy films for influence, or if there's anything you kind of had in mind when you were tackling this project.
Well, we did look at a few, and the one that really stood out was The Spy Who Came In From the Cold. Because we were looking mostly, actually, I mean, I've seen a lot of other spy movies and enjoyed them, but we were looking mostly at sort of period movies from the same kind of time. And what I loved about that was the sort of completely unglamorous world that it portrayed. Sort of gritty and really rather unpleasant. And I thought, oh, that feels a bit more like something that's a bit more real. And also it had a sort of sustained, slow, steady intensity to it that I thought was brilliant. I had seen it years ago, actually, but as I came back to it. And actually, otherwise, the influences on the film were more from sort of Hitchcock and other types of movies from the period than other spy movies.
Any particular Hitchcock movies that jumped out?
Well, the one that I looked at really, I mean, I'm a Hitchcock nut anyway, so yeah. I know the films quite well. But the one that I looked at a lot was North by Northwest, which partly because it was around the same time, it was made around the same time as the events of the movie, but also because he's so good at sort of getting what it's like to be in a situation that is beyond your control, you know, and that sort of strange paranoia. I mean, it is a different sort of register to this movie, but I think that's so amazing the way that film, you know, you are constantly trying to catch up with what the hell is going, or rather he's constantly trying to catch up, Cary Grant. And it really influenced the way I thought about shooting the movie because what he does, I mean, the example I would give is, and the one I looked at, the sequence I looked at really closely is that incredible sequence in the cornfields with the crop sprayer and how he constructs that, which is very typical of him. He sort of uses three camera angles. One is a sort of wide shot, which isolates the person in the setting. So you sort of get their vulnerability. Then you go to the sort of reaction on quite tight on Cary Grant. And then you get to the clean POV, which we used a lot, clean point of view, which basically and seeing the world through the eyes of the protagonist. And the combination of those three types of shot we used a lot in this movie. And Hitchcock uses it. It's in the shower scene. It's in all the, that combination is in all the key moments in Hitchcock. And it's a magic combination because it gives you all the information you need, really. But clean POV is so valuable in the mix because it really does sort of put you into the boots of the character. And if you look at the way we did him arriving at the airport, for example, in Moscow, we sort of used that sequence, that combination. Yeah.
Very nice.
So my next question kind of follows on from the first one, which was your process of getting into the film. And you mentioned you were sort of handed the script and you didn't know it was a real story at the time. But once you got into that and the process of actually putting it on the screen, how did you deal with it being a real story and translating that to the screen?
Well, you've got, you know, it's such a complex question, this, because you've got your loyalty to the real people. And I think you've sort of got to honor the spirit, at the very least, of who they are and what happened. But at the same time, you've got to make something that's compressed, hugely compressed. I mean, if you're doing a TV series, you've got much more space to sort of get into the nuances and the sort of the subplots and all of that. You have far less time, so you've got to compress everything right down, and you've got to sort of make something exciting. So you're not torn, but one's always trying to bring those two elements together. And I always feel that if you're doing something that's drawn from real life, you really do need to do your research. And you need to act in a sort of totally pragmatic response in terms of what you find. You've got to only really use the stuff that's going to enhance the film. And the other key thing, of course, is that you need a guiding principle by which you can edit out information that's not useful. So you've got to decide what sort of film you're going to make. It happens also when people do novels. Same thing happens, because if you do a novel's like, how long does it take to read a novel? It's like days. But you're trying to get a novel down to 2 hours, you have to decide which bit of the novel you're going to talk about. So for us, we sort of started with the friendship at the center of the story being the sort of axis on which the whole thing tilts, and that being the heart of the movie. So that meant that there were lots of amazing parts of the story that we just didn't get into. And then once I started doing the reading, it was so interesting. I mean, it was fascinating, and there were elements of research that I'd found that sort of ended up in the movie and shaped our understanding of things. And other bits you have to leave behind. And of course, as you'll know, the really hard thing about researching a subject like that, this is that it is by its very, it's by its necessity, secret. And there is a lot of sort of fake news and actually the propaganda around this particular story was huge. Especially in the Soviet Union. I mean, they still in Russia don't know what actually happened. What is accepted there is the Soviet version of events, which was totally constructed to defame Penkovsky. It's totally fake. They had a show trial, and there was a documentary made in the maybe 70s about it in the Soviet era. And of course, the authorities were so embarrassed because he was so high up. There was so much information given to the West. They had to do stuff to sort of help them get away with it, and they defamed him, and that version of events still exists now, so much so that when we went over to cast the movie, we were given quite a hard time by a lot of people about what a terrible traitor he was, how he wasn't a war hero at all, even though he was decorated 13 times, he'd been in an office. These things, which were put into a TV documentary, have become fact. And so that sort of willful distortion of the story, and the very interesting thing that happened with Rebel Wim, which was that he was sort of told to shut up by MI6 because otherwise they would take away his pension, because he was going on television and writing books where he was telling a mixture of truths and sort of self-aggrandizing fictions, meant that the story was really inaccessible. There's a brilliant book, The Spy Who Saved the World, which I came to quite late in my research, which is based on the CIA papers, which I think released in the 90s. So that was the first book I read that was totally rooted in concrete information. Incredibly helpful, because, you know, you've got your script, but you need to sort of understand the bigger picture. And that was, I found that really useful.
Now, I'm curious, the setting for this movie and the locations were beautiful. Like, I thought the mood that came through those locations was really, really effective. And I'm just curious what the challenges you faced recreating, you know, Cold War era Moscow in this film.
Yeah, that was quite hard. I mean, I had actually been to Soviet Russia in the 80s on a school trip, which was unbelievably helpful because it was even then so different to anything I had seen before and pretty much since, that it sort of helped me. And actually, that my production designer got so bored of me talking about my school trip, it became a running joke. Because every time he went on a location scout there, I'd be going on about, you know, the key lady in the hotel, or that, you know, there were so many things that were so sort of weird and unique that we tried to sort of get into the movie. But yeah, we went to quite a few places. We went to Kiev, and we went to Belarus, to Minsk. We nearly shot there, actually. We were going to do 2 days there because it's a sort of monument to Stalinism. There's an extraordinary, you know, it's still got a KGB there. It's still in that era, and a very strange place. And you know, they've still got the sort of 30-foot Lenin statues and all that. So we were going to do a lot of exteriors there, but it turned out that we couldn't get sort of, it wasn't reliable because they couldn't promise us access to the buildings we needed. So we shot it all in Prague. Some of it is sort of green screen augmented. But Prague's got a lot of brilliant architecture. And we did a huge amount of research. I mean, you know, the props are all authentic. You know, we tried to get everything absolutely bang on to sort of get the feel of that world. As accurate as we possibly could, but I have to say, the fact that I had been, and I've been to Russia a lot since for various reasons for work, was very helpful because it still is, I think, such a different culture, such a different atmosphere in Russia to Western Europe, that you sort of need to do your work really.
Right. Quick question about just Benedict Cumberbatch. I mean, he's one of the, for me, the best things about the film. His performance is fantastic. But what was it like directing him and directing him through that process? Because the physical change he goes through later on in the film is very jarring. And that flip that film takes at that point, it just makes you just like, oh. So how was that just directing Benedict and coaching him through it?
Well, I've worked with him a few times before, and he's very sort of self-correcting. He's got a very good storytelling sense. I actually think he'd be a very good director, and I've said that to him, because he knows what is required story-wise for each scene. And he's also very physical, so he sort of creates his characters physically. There's a lot of, I mean, he looked a lot at the real Grevelwyn. He looked a lot at, there was a brilliant clue in Grevelwyn actually about who he really was, because he was from a very working class background from Wales, and he had a very aspirational, slightly pushy, slightly grandiose mother who wanted the best for herself and for him. And he ended up marrying someone who was sort of upper middle class and ended up living in Chelsea. But his life was thwarted, which I think is one of the reasons why he connected so strongly with Penkovsky. His life was thwarted by very severe dyslexia, which at the time, of course, wasn't really understood or recognized. Kids who had dyslexia, he was at school, you know, during the sort of First World War, and he was, you know, put to the back of the class and treated like he was stupid when he clearly was not. And we noticed in the photographs of Wynne, in every single photograph at any point in his life, he wore the same tie. And we did our homework. I don't know how we found this out. This was not me that found it out. It was someone in the wardrobe team found out that the tie that he wore was the Nottingham University tie.
Right.
And he had not actually attended Nottingham University. However, he had attended some lectures there as an outsider. in engineering, because that was his specialty, because he couldn't have got in because of his dyslexia. And I just thought that was, we both fastened on that as a clue. I mean, actually, we did it, you know, he wears that tie in every scene. But what I thought was so interesting was, what kind of a person is it that needs to defend themselves that strongly, you know, from, or sort of put their status out there when they clearly hadn't really got that status. And I think, you know, he did have a sense of not being recognized in a way that I think Pankowski had exactly the same sense for very different reasons. And I think that that sort of grievance was part of the dynamic that, that sort of worked for them as a pairing.
I had a question about Jesse Buckley, who's definitely emerging as a major talent. And so many times when you see these real life stories translated to the screen, there's the wife at home character, which feels so underdeveloped. And I'm just really curious what the efforts you took, because this character really did have a really interesting and dynamic role throughout the movie, especially that built as the movie kept going. I'm really curious about the development of that character when you're putting this movie together.
Oh, thank you. Well, it is really hard, that what you're describing. Mm-hmm. It's a perennial question of the moment, really. It comes up a lot at the moment when you're thinking about, like, how do you tell the truth about the past, where it was white guys who were operating in the world, but honor the stories properly of the people who don't fit that category. And so it's really tricky, you know, because we weren't focusing on her as the center of the story. I mean, I have to say that we were so lucky with Jesse, because Jesse, of all the people in the film, is the person most different to the person that she's playing. She's such a sort of grounded, open, free sort of spirit. There's nothing about her that's buttoned up or hidden or indirect. She's just very sort of, here I am. And she's also way, way, way younger than the character, and yet conveys someone who's much older than she actually is. And I think the joy of that was that she absolutely reached outside her own sort of time period into that period, totally sort of got that sort of upper middle class, uptight sense that emotion is wrong and the expression of feeling is wrong. And that, unfortunately, still exists in the UK now. I think there was a sea change when Princess Diana died, sort of suddenly all right to express feeling in public, but it is part of our inheritance, it's part of the empire, it's part of the public school system. And she got that. But the great thing about Jessie is she's so full of feeling herself that the contrast, I think, between those two qualities is what makes the performance really interesting. We tried as much as we could to give her agency, and we wrote a bunch of scenes that we ended up dropping where she was sort of doing stuff more in the world. I mean, within her own sort of fairly narrow world of what a woman, you know, who wasn't working at that time would have been like, but they sort of felt extraneous, so we didn't shoot them in the end. But we tried as much as possible to get her sort of challenging him and pushing him and demanding things of him, which I think is perfectly true. I don't think there's any sense that she was some sort of passive person in history, well, you know, in the reality.
Yeah.
I'm aware of the time, so I have a couple of quick fire questions at the end, if you don't mind.
Sure. Yeah, of course.
So, okay. This is non-courier related. This is spy film. So what is your favorite spy film of all time?
You know what? I'm not going to say a film. I'm going to say the TV series of Tinker Tailor.
Oh, okay.
Oh,
from the 70s or 80s.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. It's breaking the rules.
No, we like that. It's usually Casino Royale.
It's probably now looks really, really clunky and wobbly sets. But I think the sort of acting and the scripting of that was brilliant in terms of tension, mm-hmm. stakes. And that sort of fast pulse with a really cool surface.
Yeah.
That, I mean, listen, I love the Bond movies. I love all that stuff, but I would say that, yeah.
Well, you've led me on to the next question, which is, of course, James Bond. Who is your James Bond?
Oh, wow. I thought the next one would be James Norton, but I'm not so sure now. Oh, we're talking about the next one, or the favorite is Sean Connery. It's not even worth having the conversation as far as I'm concerned. There is no one better. And you know, actually, I watched recently, what was it? Dr. No. Mm-hmm. He's such an interesting character, because he's got that sort of like brick-like masculinity, but there really is a sensuality about him that's almost feminine. And I don't mean effeminate, I mean there's a sort of softness and there's a sensuality that is so brilliant, and a wit. I think he's, yeah, no one's got close as far as I'm concerned.
I think Cam might argue with you slightly, but I'm on board. I'm with you.
No.
So who's yours, Cam? I just need to know quickly.
I always say Connery is the best, but Roger Moore is kind of my favorite. That's the one that brought me into the franchise.
Well, I mean, I get that because I grew up with Roger Moore and the humor is there, but it did become parodic in the end, didn't it? Like the latter Roger Moore movies are like, they're spoofs. They're sort of Austin Powers.
Yeah. Oh, totally. The line is very thin between Austin Powers and Roger Moore films.
Right, yeah. Actually, that's what I should have answered. My favorite spy movie.
Well, I mean, yeah, the other question I have is what's coming up for you next, Dominic? What are you working on at the moment?
It's really hard to say. I've got four theatre shows that are sort of like, it's like being in the sort of Heathrow Airport trying to do air traffic control. I have no idea when they're going to land. But film-wise, there's a film of Stephen Sondheim's musical, Follies, which is a show that I did on stage. I'm sort of developing the script of that, which is about as far away from this as you could possibly get, but a brilliant sort of piece to be working on. And then there's a film that I'm sort of trying to produce for the company I've set up called Fiction House. And the film is it's sort of drawn from those really wonderful early Woody Allen films, sort of intelligent romantic comedy. If you think about something like Annie Hall, it's that sort of world of slightly neurotic, urban, intelligent people, and using London as a romantic setting. And it's a lovely script. It's very tender and awkward and funny. It's very funny. So they're very different projects, and I don't know which one will land first, but I'm hoping something will happen next year. I don't know. I've given up making plans. I mean, it's just impossible. The more you invest in the plan, the more disappointed you're going to be. But I'm hopeful. I'm quietly hopeful.
That's all we can be these days is hopeful.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's all we have left. Yeah. Well, I mean, on behalf of Cam and myself, I want to thank you just for the film, firstly. It's just nice to see a new film right now, something different and fresh and new. And it was a joy to watch it, and it's been a joy to talk to you about it.
Thanks so much, guys. I really enjoyed that. Thank you.
Well, there you go, folks. That was part three of our Courier trilogy. Thank you to Dominic Cook for sitting down with us a few years ago. It was great to talk The Courier with him. And I think it's been great this week just to take a look at a film that I think kind of got overlooked a little bit during the COVID lack of cinemas period of VODs and things like that. And it's one that I really celebrate.
Well, it was really cool to talk to Dominic during the press tour, basically, for The Courier. And at that point, we'd both seen the movie, obviously, but we didn't have any sense of kind of how it would be embraced later down the road. So it was actually fun to go back and listen to this interview now and obviously talk to Tom O'Connor about the film recently, knowing 3 years, 4 years down the road, how this movie has gained a little bit of a reputation and is pretty acknowledged as a very effective spy story. Because back when we were doing this interview, we didn't know. This thing could have completely vanished off the face of the earth like a week after the interview.
Yeah, I mean, this episode, the original Declassified episode, came out around about the same time as our episode on Without Remorse. And I've not heard that been mentioned at all since.
No, and that's been the case for a few of the movies. Like, because you just never know when you do these press tours if the movie's going to have legs and have a little bit of a life or just completely disappear. And, you know, it's nice to see that in the case of The Courier, quality has won out and the movie is still being discovered or rediscovered over and over again. And something like Without Remorse, which maybe doesn't have that quality to speak of, has quietly just vanished into a wisp of air.
Which may or may not be for the best. I'll leave that to you all to decide. But it's been great to go back and take a deep dive into The Courier. That was kind of the mission statement with the Declassified episodes, was to have a brief look at the film. And usually we'd have an interview with someone through the press tour as well to give you a bit of context of the film. But these are meant to be when we do the proper episodes, you get a full deep dive. So this is really sort of that dream come to fruition here. And it's one of the first times we've gone from Declassified to full episode. And I think this is how I want to do it going forward.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, totally.
But there you go, folks. That wraps up our deep dive into The Courier. Do you agree with our knock list choice? Let us know. And if you enjoyed our chat with Dominic Cook, we want to hear from you. But Cam, the question goes to you, as it always does. What are we talking about next week?
People, unleash your pessimism,
because we are headed back to the 1970s to tackle the Burt Lancaster spy thriller Scorpio, co-starring Alain Delon.
Yeah, this is a film that's been mentioned to us a couple of times online. It's got an interesting cast and a very interesting premise. So I'm excited to see what Burt and Alain have for us. Obviously, Burt's resume speaks for himself. Alain Delon is most known for, you know, what's the name of that film, Cam?
Le Samurai.
Yeah.
Or are you thinking of Airport 4, The Concorde?
Oh, it's obviously the Concorde. It has to be the Concorde, of course. So, yeah, maybe we should talk about that next week. No, I'm kidding, of course. Your mission, folks, should you choose to accept it, is to join us next week as we head back to 1973 and take a look at Scorpio. Hopefully it doesn't have a sting in its tail. And if you like what you heard on this deep dive of The Courier, you know, please consider joining us over on our Patreon at patreon.com/spyhards, or you can find a link in the show notes below. Tons of options over there, and every little bit goes to helping us keep the lights on here at Spyhards HQ, because independent podcasting is not cheap and we do not have any network sponsors. It's just Cam and I keeping the lights on here and our lovely patrons who are already supporting us over on Patreon. And make sure you follow us discreetly as always on social media at Spyhards. That's SPYHARDS on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. But until next time, folks, Cam and I will be getting a head start on our Without Remorse sequel.